Hello and welcome to the third Cinnamon podcast. I'm David Simmons, and this week we will bring you the final talk of the Cinnamon Theology Symposium, which was given by the Reverend Dr. Kate Coleman of Next Leadership, whose talk is entitled Leadership and Social Transformation in a Diversifying World.
Okay, so it's my opportunity now to share my paper. I'm struck already by the degree of overlap I think that there will be in some of the things that we've been saying this morning. But I want to start with a quote from theologian, an African-American theologian, Dolores Williams, who writes, "I have come to believe that theologians in their attempt to talk to and about religious communities ought to give readers some sense of their autobiographies." Well, we've been doing that a little bit already. She goes on to say, "This can help an audience discern what leads the theologian to do the kind of theology she does, what has been the character of her faith journey, what lessons has this journey taught, what kind of faith inspires her to continue writing and rewriting, living and reliving theology in a highly secular, white and black world, paying little or no attention to what theologians are saying." Well, I'm going to take her advice. We've all been doing that to some degree. But what I want to do is I want to give you a little bit of a fuller picture of who I am and of where I'm coming from. And it will help to explain why I'm saying some of the things that I'm saying in this time. So my name is Kate Coleman. And for nearly 30 years, I've served as a Baptist minister in both London and here in Birmingham. I've been mostly located in either urban church resuscitation or church planting contexts. In 2006-07, I served as president of the Baptist Union, and I've just completed, well, just over a year or so ago now, completed a term as chair of the Evangelical Lights Council. If I had to paint a picture of myself, I always start by saying these things. I would paint a picture of three streams that flow into one river. The first stream would be the stream that represents mission in its narrowest and its broadest sense. Mission as evangelism, as wanting men and women to come to know and to follow Jesus. In that sense, I'm a true evangelical, unapologetically so. But also mission in its broadest sense, as the flourishing of human society. And the belief that wherever Christians live and serve, wherever they're praying into, that actually there should be some expression of the kingdom of God manifest in that place and in that space. So that's the first stream. The second stream is diversity, particularly as it relates to gender and ethnicity and culture. Perhaps for obvious reasons, I've learned to value the fact that I sometimes see things differently to my colleagues and to others around me. The third stream is leadership, and these days I spend a considerable amount of my time mentoring leaders or delivering leadership formation programs for leadership from across all sectors, including church leaders. In this season of my life, I find myself particularly exercised around the theme and issues surrounding women's leadership, hence the title of my book, for those of you who have seen it, Seven Deadly Sins of Women in Leadership. Now, I was 18 years old when I encountered Jesus, and it was, if you like, my first defining moment, to use that phrase. I was not without spiritual awareness. I lived in Camden in London, which meant that I was no stranger to spirituality of all kinds. A bit of a sweet shop for spirituality, New Age ideologies. I wasn't a stranger to the power of spirituality. But my encounter with Jesus took everyone, including myself, by surprise, largely because I'd spent so long avoiding Christians, particularly the boring ones, and Christianity. Then, in no uncertain terms, I encountered Jesus in the most powerful way imaginable, and it was a Damascus Road experience for me. I knew that God was real, I knew that God meant business, and subsequently, I know that Jesus doesn't simply work through us or for us, but he works in us and with us. The second defining moment I'd like to share came 3 years later, while I was halfway up a mountain in Scotland, trying to figure out what God wanted me to do with the rest of my life after university. I had very good ideas, God didn't think they were as good as his. So while I was there, God called me to church leadership, another huge surprise because my church didn't believe in women in leadership and neither did I. So 2 years later, I was leading that same church. And it was not without its challenges. It came at great cost. And I lost valued friends in the process of walking in obedience to that call. Many more years later, while I was actually in church leadership, I had another defining moment. I had been wrestling for some time with the experience of being a young, because I was then, single black woman minister. Apparently, I was the only black Baptist woman minister in the UK at the time. I didn't look like anyone else. I didn't preach like anyone else. I didn't approach things like anyone else. Ministers, like other ministers, seemed to. And I was constantly being told that the way I did things was, well, wrong. That season was an extremely steep learning curve. But through it all, I came to one startling conclusion, that God had called me not in spite of who I am, but because of who I am. Oh, we're having church in here. Okay. I became conscious that my unique experiences and perspectives and approaches were as much God's gift to the church as anyone else's. And I began to help other women and so-called minorities to embrace their gift of identity in a context that often rejected it. When I was at primary school, there used to be a joke told about God. It went something like this. I saw God last night. To which the response is made, really, what was he like? The punchline then follows, well, God is a woman and she's black. Unfortunately, I didn't get this joke until I was an adult. It was then that I realized the true power behind it. The point that it makes, of course, is that most people's behavioral and theological perception of God is already spoken for. Gender and race have nothing to do with it until they have anything to do with it. For by and large, the acceptable face of God and theology is Western, European, and male. But what does any of this have to do with theology, leadership, and social transformation in a diversifying world? Well, everything, really. Because it is inevitable that we will be leading in escalating levels of diversity. Whatever your present context, it will become more diverse and complex over time. This so-called VUCA environment, that's volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, is compounded by the explosion of information technology, immigration, emigration, war, terror, increasing globalization, outsourcing, the ease with which people can travel to the so-called uttermost parts of the world on holiday or for mission, the ease with which the rest of the world travels here, the speed with which a variety of Christians can share their convictions, for better or for worse, in a matter of moments with a global audience and across multiple boundaries, the increasing contact that people have in their work and places of worship with ideologies, philosophies, and religions arising from other contexts. It never ceases to amaze me the number of times I hear Christian leaders say, "My context is monocultural. I don't have to deal with issues of racism or ethnocentrism or Islam. These are irrelevant for me and my people. Diversity is not a major concern." My response is always the same, that anyone who reads the national newspaper or watches the daily news is already interacting with diversity on a global scale. The real challenge is not our exposure. The real challenge is that our opinions and mindsets are being shaped by forces that are neither biblical nor theologically robust. And this is regardless of whether the people and the events in our own backyards appear to be monocultural. An additional challenge, of course, is the invisible challenge. Because diversity is not limited to ethnicity, culture, or gender, but is also determined by multi-generational differences. There are now 4 generations in ministry and in the workplace, all with different ideas about what is appropriate leadership, work practices, and dress codes. There is ongoing social inequality, escalating environmental degradation. Church leaders increasingly have to interact with a variety of sectors and ideologies and disciplines and organizational cultures and subcultures that they never had to when I started ministry. The issues I had to deal with at the beginning of my ministry were very different from the issues I was dealing with at the end of my ministry, local church ministry. By that time, dealing with staff, buildings, food, and children alone meant having to handle legal requirements of local councils, employment law, safeguarding, health and safety, and these continue to grow in complexity. Then, of course, the cultures we think we know also have subcultures that we don't often understand, each one operating according to different values, assumptions, and sometimes different dress codes and in-house language. The reality is that we are being forced to pay attention to things that have usually, for most part, have always been there, but we have never noted before, and having to interact with identities being asserted in ways that we've never experienced before. Our current environment may be providing our churches with unprecedented opportunities. They are, partially because they're relatively flexible organisms and they mobilize quickly, but they're also presenting us with exactly the same leadership challenges that everyone else is facing. For many churches, the prospect of engagement in all of this carries with it the very real fear and concern of literally having to enter entirely new worlds. One size never did fit all, and we must now search for resources, biblical resources, that enable us to become more effective in our leadership and our discipleship in an increasingly diverse world. This is no small task, for we are in new territory, and most of us have never seen anything like it. All of this makes having a mentality attuned to diversity almost a requirement for survival and progress, and equipping leaders to deal with difference in ways that honors God's image in others is a priority. Difference or diversity in and of itself does not present the real challenge. It's how we understand, relate to, and lead difference in practice that makes it potentially dangerous or destructive or divisive. So what are the possible ways forward? What I want to do is tentatively sketch. I'm one of those activists that Martin was talking about, so that's the way that I've framed this whole paper. I want to tentatively sketch three metaphors of leadership and three images of social transformation that we must wrestle with in the UK church in particular. The first is the Tower of Babel from Genesis 11. Verses 1 to 9. I'm going to just read this text for us. Now, the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let's make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth." But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower they were building. The Lord said, "If as one people speaking the same language they have begun to do this, then nothing they plan to do will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other." So the Lord scattered them from there all over all the earth, and they stopped building the city. That is why it was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. Now this may seem like a strange image to describe leadership in this era. Nonetheless, it describes an approach to leadership that depends upon a uniformity of language, a homogeneity of culture, and a focus of purpose that actually succeeds in producing a stairway to heaven. It's an approach that leads to rapid growth, but is utterly defined and directed by one domineering cultural paradigm, where leaders are remade in the image of their predecessors. Increasingly, in Babel, this paradigm meets with God's judgment rather than God's sanction. Even though the building of this tower itself, a marvel of human achievement using innovative technology, brick instead of stone, bitumen for mortar, does not actually emerge from an attempt to storm heaven or even to gain independence from God, but instead out of a desire for community, identity, security, and a commitment to create the conditions for a divine human encounter. This is social transformation at its most compelling and perhaps its most tempting. In many ways, the tower is a reflection of our modern preoccupation with size, wealth, power, and status, all the trappings of worldly success, none of which are intrinsically wrong. However, like mammon, our love of them may be leading us further rather than closer to the God we seek. As a metaphor, it reflects what happens to leadership and social transformation when human beings are left to their own devices. We tend to build to create our own impression rather than God's. In this scenario, God is simultaneously impressed by their achievement and alarmed by the implications that any one community, single language, or culture should assume to have a monopoly on the divine. Unfortunately, this reflects the history of a significant proportion of mainstream mission, church leadership, and theology, particularly in and from the West. The assumption of many modernist theologians is that there is one acceptable language and culture in theology and church leadership. Like Babel, such theology is said to speak for everyone and to everywhere because it speaks from nowhere. However, upon closer scrutiny, is frequently Euro-American, and certainly within evangelicalism, is particularly preoccupied with dead Swiss and German men. It is our present context that seriously challenges this assertion, and what was once invisible has become visible. Theologian James Cone puts it very helpfully. He said, although God, the subject of theology, is eternal, theology itself, like those who articulate it, is limited by history and time. Our image of God is finite image, limited by the temporality and particularity of our existence. In other words, God doesn't do theology. We do. Our telling of God's story, our theology, is never neutral. In some way, it reflects, it reveals, it even betrays our gender, our history, our values, our ethics, our traditions, and our culture, and even as it shapes and informs these things. It has been expressed in this way. No one comes to God's sacred storybook storyless. There is little challenge involved in building something that looks, sounds, and behaves like us. The real socially transformative challenge lies elsewhere, and the dangers of attempting to monopolize God in our era are still very real. The dangers of building the single structure or single idea, be it theological, organizational, to end all others, remains a significant challenge. In this instance, God responds by scattering the peoples and confusing the languages. The second image is the image of the day of Pentecost in Acts 2. This describes the birth of the New Testament leadership and the New Testament church. A new breed of leaders are released who are transitioning from a Tower of Babel-like paradigm into something very different. Here, Pentecost is almost a counterpoint to the Tower of Babel story, in that it represents a scenario in which a multicultural, multilingual, multinational, mixed-gender gathering are powerfully impacted by the preaching of Peter and the influence of the Holy Spirit. For the first time in the biblical text, we're presented with a tantalizing promise of diversity and wholesale gender equality. God not only accepts different languages, he introduces a few more through the Spirit-inspired speech of the disciples. As we will see, Jerusalem at Pentecost was remarkably cosmopolitan. Acts 2, verse 5. Now there were staying in Jerusalem God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven. Verse 8. Each one of us hears them in his own native tongue. Parthians, Medes, Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea, Cappadocia, Pontus, Asia, Phrygia, Pamphylia, Egypt, and the parts of Libya near Cyrene. Visitors from Rome, Cretans, and Arabs, we hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues. The biblical world, that group of people, we see Southern Europeans, Arabs, Asians, and Africans. The biblical world also had subcultures within these broader national and regional cultures. For example, within Judaism, there are groups that are often mentioned together in the Bible, Sadducees and Pharisees, that often held virtually opposing political and religious views and held different positions on the social ladder. The religious subcultural groupings also included the Essenes and the Zealots. Simon, one of Jesus' disciples, belonged to this faction. However, the group described in Acts 2 were culturally Jews from all over the known world. And the mission in the early part of the book of Acts was almost entirely directed towards them. The early sermons throughout Acts are clear that the message to this group was fairly uniform, because for all their diversity, they shared the cultural and religious assumptions of Judaism and a Judaic worldview. But these assumptions came under intense pressure from a number of factors, namely, increasing numbers of Gentile believers. Secondly, divine intervention through dreams and the visitation of angels directing Jewish believers to preach and interact with Gentiles. Thirdly, the Apostle Paul, who was eventually assigned to preach to the Gentiles, who challenged the assumptions of his Jewish peers toward them. Fourthly, the Jerusalem Council, which eventually took bold steps to free Gentile believers from the constraints of having to believe and behave like Jews in order to be accepted as Christians. Issues of diversity always present challenges, but they also present opportunities for us to revisit our convictions. There's no doubt that contemporary culture has enabled us to ask new questions of the biblical text and its interpreters in a way that a Babel-like pursuit of God would never allow. This is why the shift to Pentecost and God's express acceptance of many languages is so significant. It is so often the introduction of new voices that enable us to see and hear what could not be seen and heard before. However, the Pentecost vision embraces a diversity of contributors, not a diversity of contributions. A church birthed in a context of Roman colonial rule stalled, ironically, when it sought to apply a colonial model that defined acceptable norms for those who held a very different worldview. It takes another act of scattering through the forces of persecution to mobilize the church towards fulfilling the Great Commission and the cultural mandate of Genesis 1, 26 to 28. It comes through a kingdom orientation, and subsequently faith in Jesus continues to find expression through acts of social transformation as the early church begins to provide answers to social division and inequities that their own world had no answer for. Ultimately, Pentecost only marks the beginning of mission and leadership in the New Testament, rather than the end of it. So you can see I'm on a trajectory. The last image I want to present is an image of an open heaven. It's found in Revelation chapter 7, verse 9. After this, I looked, and there before me was a great multitude that no one could count, from every nation, tribe, people, and language, standing before the throne and before the Lamb. They were wearing white robes and were holding palm branches in their hands, and they cried out in a loud voice, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." This image has always intrigued me and inspired me because it's a snapshot of the conditions where Christ reigns supreme. And where we do our own work in social transformation, those are the conditions we're seeking to operate and work through. The writer says, "After this, I looked." How did the writer know? He saw. He witnessed the event with his own senses. In some way, the distinctives of nations, tribes, peoples, and languages were visible for him to see. There is something about these distinctives that are valuable to the point that they're actually represented in the vision of an open heaven. Our attempts at social transformation often make the mistake of seeking to assimilate and to blend. We may advocate and promote the idea of color or cultural blindness, but apparently God does not. Statements like, "I'm colorblind," or "Kate, to me you're not black, you're just Kate," are not quite as helpful as they sound. As much as I appreciate where people are coming from when they make such statements, The reality is that until we see who someone actually is, whether it's their culture, ethnicity, gender, accent, wealth, poverty, etc., we can never participate in the Apostle Paul's mission to become all things to all. Human particularity, or the things that distinguish us from one another, also inform our social standing and can make a difference between whether a person gets spat at or ignored, whether they get beaten up on the bus, as some of our Eastern European friends used to face whenever they open their mouths, whether they are counted as powerful or powerless, discriminated against or not. When we fail to recognize or name difference, we aren't really paying attention to the real conditions of someone else's life. And however well-meaning we may be, we are effectively erasing the reality of their social location, or their cultural context, or their linguistic expression, or their material conditions, and the day-to-day reality of their lives. Social transformation is not possible until these distinctives are properly accounted for. Not only are the people and their distinctives recognizable in this vision of heaven, but the things they have in common are also recognized, and they include a marked lack of status, priority, or superiority. They were all wearing white robes, all holding palm branches, with their distinctives very much intact. They are not homogenized or constrained by their common identity as saints and worshippers of God. It was African-American novelist and scholar Alice Walker, long alienated from Christianity, who famously, and I think insightfully, wrote, "I believe that the truth about any subject only comes when all sides of the story are put together, and all their different meanings make one new one. Each writer writes the missing parts to the other writer's story, and the whole story is what I'm after." So I realize I just haven't been clicking this thing away. Anyway, it's not much there for you to see. The whole story, of course, points beyond all human languages, social locations, and cultural identities. It privileges no one culture, because the whole story points to Christ, Lord over all. What then does it mean for leaders committed to social transformation to pray on earth as it is in heaven? Surely it means more than simply inviting diversity to the table. Christians are certainly getting better at recognizing and embracing the diversity of churches and traditions within their vicinity. However, deep social transformation isn't possible until we learn how best to engage across sectors, ideology, philosophy, religion, ethnic, racial, generational, organizational cultures, and subcultures. And of course, until we learn to embody diversity and to lead it. Paul took his step to become all things to all in order to save some. We're invited to participate for the same reason. In the past, much Christian leadership was exercised on the basis of strength and position. Leadership looked more like telling, whereas today it's impossible, in fact, to lead well without ownership and commitment. Leadership looks far more like listening. It will always be easier to work alongside and agree with people who look, sound, and behave like us. However, diversity presents an opportunity for unity and more. There is a well-worn phrase that goes something like this: there's no true unity without diversity. This, of course, misses the point, because unity is not the only goal for diversity. Mutuality is also a goal. Mutuality is the ability to build relationships based on equality, reciprocity, interdependence, and accountability. And it more closely approximates the leadership paradigm presented by the metaphor of Revelation 7, verse 9. Herein lies the challenge. It may be clear that we shouldn't aim for a leadership paradigm informed by the metaphor of the Tower of Babel. But it isn't always clear that as a metaphor, Pentecost, though exciting and promising, is also an inadequate paradigm for leadership and social transformation. When leadership reflects the diversity of a church and their surrounding community, it approaches unity. When every voice is truly heard at the leadership table, and then only then does it approach mutuality. In this way, diversity becomes God's opportunity rather than our problem. In this way, our faith offers a corrective to culture in the same way as the New Testament church, rather than once again reflecting cultural self-interest of any kind you care to mention. This makes, for me, Revelation 7 an even more compelling metaphor for leadership and model for social transformation. It's not even as if this constitutes a new vision. It's rather a reminder and a pointer back to the disciples' prayer, on earth as it is in heaven. What are we to do with all this as leaders? Very briefly. Thankfully, we're not the first disciples and leaders to have wrestled with such issues. The New Testament has many lessons to teach us in a society where the cultural makeup is constantly changing, where culture itself is moving, and where ideas of right and wrong are rapidly shifting. Leading in diversity presents an opportunity to promote diverse contributions as well as diverse contributors, to explore global perspectives, which I think we've been wrestling with here, and traditions that critique and learn from each other, including their theological paradigms, rather than privileging Western culture, Western preoccupations. We lead at a critical point in world history where diversities threaten to tear apart the fabric within and between nations, and at the same time lead to the best bottom line results multinationals could ever wish for. In order for 21st century leadership to prove socially transformative, it must resist the twin temptations to patronize by embracing collaboration and the temptation to paternalize by pressing for partnership through honest exchange of ideas, vision, and initiative. Social transformation in the past was often characterized by the doing of things to people rather than with them. In our landscape, leadership becomes an intrinsically mutual exercise. We may still tell, but we are now committed to ask, listen, and learn from each other. We lead under very different conditions to those who came before us. We can, of course, continue to build towers or even applaud ourselves over our ability to gather difference around the table, or we can reach for something far more kingdom-oriented, something that's a bit more on earth as it is in heaven.
That was the Reverend Dr. Kate Coleman from the Cinnamon Theology Symposium in Birmingham that was held earlier this month in partnership with Four Mission College. For more information about Cinnamon Network, our purpose, our recognised projects and our microgrants, head to www.cinnamonnetwork.co.uk. You can follow us on Twitter, at Cinnamon Network. You can like us on Facebook. And you can subscribe to our weekly emails. Simply head to our homepage and click on Get News by Mail. Thank you for listening.